Visualize a stack of fresh homemade pancakes, and then visualize opening a bottle of some high fructose corn syrup based, artificially flavored, thick as cold motor oil goo to pour over those cakes of goodness. What a waste of food and effort to destroy them with synthetic yuck. Yeah, the price point might be agreeable, but if you read the ingredients, no amount of a bet should sway you to eat those ingredients. Pure maple syrup from sugar maple trees made the old-fashioned way is just what those pancakes and you deserve. Join me on today's episode of the Culinary Libertarian Podcast to find out how maple syrup is made. The Culinary Libertarian Podcast, episode 71.
Welcome to the Culinary Libertarian Podcast, where the philosophy is free, but the food is on you.
Hello, folks. Welcome back to the podcast. Dan Reed here, the Culinary Libertarian. Happy to have you here. Happy to be here. Surf over to my podcasts page, culinarylibertarian.com/podcasts, to find all the previous shows, their show notes pages, and MP3 links of each episode. You can also click on one of a few podcatchers which host the show. Click the support link to find the ways to support the show, either with subscriptions to the Tom Woods Liberty Classroom or Brian McClanahan's McClanahan Academy. Both are excellent resources for history, and the Liberty Classroom program also presents courses in logic, economics, and politics. When you get the lifetime membership to Liberty Classroom, not only do you get access to all the courses now, but all the courses to be released. Click through to see the amazing, and it really is, content of courses. The Western Civilization to 1500 alone is better than any college class, and with reading suggestions for even more learning, you will be the academic envy at work. Support the show with a click of the mouse on your favorite podcatcher in the form of a rating and a review. Those actions let the math mice know to let more people find it, and that helps grow the show. My guest today is Casey Menchoffer of Menchoffer Maple Syrup in Ohio. She's in the making maple syrup business and a cottage food vendor, and I want to talk to her about the process of making maple syrup and her observations of decentralized food laws. Welcome, Casey. Thank you for joining me today on the Culinary Libertarian Podcast.
Hi, Dan.
Before we get going into our topic today, which is maple syrup and a few other things around that, give us a little bit of a background on how you got here. How did you end up in maple syrup and the maple syrup business?
I definitely joined into the business through marriage. All I knew was Aunt Jemima growing up and didn't realize there was anything different. And it was actually while I was dating my husband that his family just decided to give it a try. They had found some old scars in trees that they owned on their property and realized that their a few generations before had tapped trees on the property and thought that they would give it a try. They did some research, and I was just happened to be along for the ride.
Well, that's an interesting ride, I'm sure. So, and we're going to talk a little bit about that. So let's start with the basics, which is the sap. Tell the folks what is done to get the sap out of the tree, because I think that I know how it's done, and certainly you do, but I think that that may be one of those things that just sort of like, gosh, how do they do that? So how do you do that? How does one get sap out of a maple tree?
Well, I guess I don't know how other people do it, but I can go from our experience, and that is they drill a hole into a sugar maple tree. And they then put in a tap, and that can be metal, it can be plastic. It just depends on what tool they decide to use that time. They've experimented different ways. And then once you do that, the tree constricts and expands repeatedly during the late winter, early spring season here in Ohio. So the freeze and the thaw is what makes that sap go up and down through the tree to feed itself. And then that sap leaks through those holes that we've drilled into it and comes out the tap.
Okay. And I think a lot of people would be surprised to find out that tree tapping time is probably getting pretty close.
It is. Yeah. We typically tap mid-February until mid-March. That fluctuates depending on the temperatures at any given time, but that's typically how that happens.
Now, this is something I don't know the answer to. Say from mid-March on, is there a change in either the chemical composition or the quality of the sap that makes it either unavailable or undesirable?
Absolutely. So once the weather becomes warm enough that the trees bud, then we stop. The sap both needs to be going to the tree and its needs, and then also the sap does become different flavored that would not be something you would want to turn into syrup.
Okay. I've seen, and anybody who's driven around, well, I'm Ohio, obviously, but so in my experience was in Michigan, but anybody who has seen sugar maple trees may have seen lots of trees with buckets hanging on the outside of the trees. Are you bucket brigading the sap, or have you gone to a PVC system?
We've morphed in the middle of all that. So to start, we did do the buckets. And from there, we moved on to milk jugs that we took holes out of the milk jugs and hung them on the trees on the taps. And now we've moved on to a sort of plastic bag that has a hole already in it, and the sap drops into that. We then tip the bag that has another hole in the corner so that it can be poured into a large 5-gallon bucket or other receptacle, and then poured into another larger one that we then take back to the fires.
Interesting. Well, I suppose there's many different ways to accomplish the goal.
Right. It's very flat here and not hilly at all. So the PVC system would be difficult to do for us because there's no difference in elevation.
So gravity would not be helpful.
No, not very much.
Oh, okay. Well, I didn't think about that. How many acres of trees do you have?
It's probably easier to just say we put more than 300 taps in a year. And some of those trees.
Well, that was really what my question was going to be.
Right. So acre-wise, I'm not sure how many that is, but trees, it's at least 300 taps. Some of those could be singles in a tree and sometimes up to three in a tree.
And I realize that year to year, this is going to change, but what is your average yield of sap?
Oh, man. Over the years, it's ranged. For us, I'm going to guess 40 to 80 gallons. It really depends on the year.
Per tree?
Of sap. Multiply that by anywhere from 40 to 60 gallons, because that's what the ratio is for us typically. 40 to 60 gallons of sap, then it takes to make 1 gallon of syrup.
Right, and that was one of the things we were going to get to, is I think that it's a shock to consider this vast quantity, and there's I wrote a blog piece about a different maple syrup producer in northern Lower Michigan, and they've got a giant, I guess they would call it an evaporator, which holds I think 6,000 gallons of sap at a time,
right?
Which is a lot of sap, and it's you have to see the picture of the thing to visualize what this means. The first time I ever saw this happening was in my new town in northern Michigan called Traverse City. And on the next block, there was some old farts standing around this fire. And on top of the fire, on some bricks or something, was this little 2x4 a 2-foot by 4-foot pan, maybe 6 inches deep, that had like 3 separate compartments separated by steel. And then at the, underneath at the bottom of the pan was a little teeny tiny little like doorway. And they had sap boiling away under under the pan was this hardwood fire, probably maple. And it was just they would put the sap in on one side, and somehow, and this was interesting to me, somehow, I guess through sugar density, the sap knew how to travel from compartment A to compartment B to compartment C. And by the time it got there, someone was skimming off the scum. And then after that, I really don't know. Probably it was bottled and littered off and cooled or something. But I would imagine when you're doing the quantity you're doing, we're not standing around a teeny evaporating pan. So what does this look like at a commercial level? How are we evaporating maple sap into syrup?
Well, we're still more old school, kind of a morph between the old ways and the new ways. We don't have an evaporator, but we do have a stainless steel pan adjusted over some fires that we use, and we test until it gets to a certain temperature and Brix level. The amount of sugar in the liquid is tested to know when it's ready to come off that fire. So rather than going through those different compartments, we have just the one single compartment. It's pretty neat to watch the evaporators, but we haven't gotten to that point yet. But it started out right in like a cast iron witch's kettle is what I always thought. That's the first way that they tried it out. But we've moved up into the stainless steel pans now.
I don't know why it never occurred to me that before stainless steel existed, somebody was doing this, and that cast iron would probably have been the right choice, or copper. And I guess from a, I'm probably overthinking all this, but from a sugar standpoint, thinking about when a confectioner is making caramel or cooking sugar for fudge or for sugar work, copper is the best choice. Copper is very expensive, so cast iron becomes more affordable. I don't know if there's any sort of chemical reaction happening there, and that's not really the point of this particular show, but it's got me wondering a little bit, so it's kind of interesting.
Right, and when we used the cast iron kettles, it was really just for home use, so yeah, it would be interesting to know if it would have affected the flavor compared to the way we do it today.
So you brought up the Brix, and I know that probably most people don't know that, and then I think just quickly, it's a way to measure, well, you explain what Brix is.
I wish that I could in a good way. I know that they have a tool that they use to measure it. I know it has something to do with the sugar levels. That's science that I don't really care about. I care far more about eating it in the end.
Okay. Well, that's okay, because it's people can find that out and they can go do their Google search for that. But there's a way. So you're reaching a particular number and determining that it is done based on the Brix reading. Now, I'm going to go into grading just a little bit, and actually, we'll get to that in a second. I want to back up a minute and go to the fire. What kind of wood are you using for your fire?
A lot of it is ash. We, unfortunately, have suffered from the emerald ash borer, like most of the country, I believe, has at this point. And so we've lost a lot of our ash trees, and since we have quite a bit of woods to choose from, those ash trees are easy pickings. Along with any other wood that is ready to be cut. And it's very labor intensive. I hope that's something that we can let your listeners know, that the reason why syrup is often so expensive is the amount of labor that not only goes into the syrup making, but to fire those fires, there's a lot of wood chopping, unless you're using propane.
Having lived in northern Michigan and heating our house exclusively with a single wood stove, when it was a big house, but it did a good job. We'd go through 17 face cord of wood every winter. So I'm familiar with what it takes to accumulate a fair bit of wood. And we had, there was the Dutch elm disease, and we just had just scores of elm ready, pretty much at the ready. And we had to fell the ones that were standing at the risk of them falling on somebody. So the ash thing is too bad. It's unfortunate. I hope they've fixed the problem.
I haven't heard much about it, but we've probably lost so many of the ashes that now nobody talks about it. It's just something that happened, and now there's the population's not there anymore.
Hmm. Casey, I want to ask you about how to pick the right bottle from the store shelves. But before I do, let's take a moment for a word out from my sponsor. Hey, folks, if you haven't heard about Anchor, it's the easiest way to make a podcast. Let me tell you why. It's free. Free is good. They have creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcasts right from your phone or your computer. Anchor will distribute your podcast for you, so it can be heard on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, CastBox, and many more. You can make money from your podcast with sponsors, just like this one, with no minimum listenership. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. And if you use your phone, you can be podcast on the spot, getting news and interesting things, whatever appeals to you, wherever you are. Download the free app to your phone or go to anchor.fm to get started creating your podcast today. You've listened to The World on Podcasts. Now go tell the world your story. Visit anchor.fm today to get started. Now let's get back into the show. Do you know, does the change of wood have any impact on the flavor of the syrup? And I can't imagine that it would, but it certainly is a possibility. If maybe like the smoke, I don't know, dancing across, it's kind of poetic, dancing across the sap. I mean, it's kind of a fun image, but is there really any smokiness coming from the wood, or is that just purely a heat function?
The point of it is just the heat function. I do notice a smoky flavor in some batches versus others, but it's very much in the back. You don't notice it very much unless you've had a lot of syrup that you've tasted in the days.
Right. All right. So let's talk about the grading part a little bit. Now, a few years ago, somebody had the really genius idea to end the grading system that was on bottles in the grocery store. And that's how most of us get our stuff, is we go to our local, whatever the grocery store is, and we look at the bottles. And grade A, now this is where things go backwards. Grade A would, of course, be the most popular seller, but grade B was a better syrup, in my opinion, because it was cooked longer and it had a deeper maple flavor, but it also had a higher price tag because you're starting with the same amount of sap but getting less syrup. So in the absence of commercial grading, how are you distinguishing kinds?
We mostly sell to just local people, and we do still grade with that grade B all the way through Vermont Fancy, which is the old grading system, just because that's what our customers are used to. We don't put anything on grocery store shelves, so we don't really worry too much about that grading system. And we have a test kit that shows us the different colors, and then we match up what the batch is compared to those colors in that test kit. And some customers request grade B, and so the ones that we believe to be grade B, that's the ones that we give them.
Well, and that's good. And that's, I think it's better. It's harder to find what I'm looking for because they have changed the labels. And so when people are out in the stores and they're not shopping from you or a local to them maple syrup producer, what do they look for? How can they look at a bottle now and determine that of the real maple syrups that are facing me? The variety has increased, although I know that, I don't actually know anything, but I think that a lot of the stuff is pretty industrialized and a commercial level, where you're getting the same brand from Seattle to Portland, Maine. So that's, while the standardization might be a convenience for the traveling maple syrup buyer, it's also taking away from the local, pardon, pun intended, the local flavor of maple syrup. But so that consumer facing these maple syrups, how does that person decide for flavor, which is the best one.
Right. I did, after we talked about going forward with this podcast, I looked at our grocery store shelves and kind of looked at the maple syrup section, since I normally pass on by that because we have plenty of our own. And the ones that had the glass bottles all looked identical. So I really would not have been able to tell which one would have been better for my purposes than another. But there are some that are in opaque bottles, plastic ones that you can't see through. And that's actually the ones that I would go for, because light hasn't been able to affect the color and fade it. You would know that whatever was put into that bottle is probably the same color that's going to come back out. And that's where I would probably advise people to go towards, is the ones that you can't see through, as long as you've got to make sure that the label says pure maple syrup. If it says table syrup in any way, shape, or form, that means that it's not made from just plain old sap. There's, look at the ingredient label, and it's going to be everything but that.
Now, the light is a good point, and I've found that the stuff in the jugs I like better, but that's also, it's giving me the flavor I want. I'm not sure, this is getting kind of into the big guy end of this, because I don't know if there are, is there cartelization or some sort of guild in the maple syrup industry where you are, well, I'll use the word coerced to participate, or is it, are you allowed to function independent and outside of the mega maple industry?
I don't know about other states, but Ohio actually has some great, both cottage food laws and the maple syrup laws are very, there's a lot of freedom there to do as you choose, as long as you have your labels done correctly. And that's stating that there is a single ingredient, unless you do add something such as salt or other sorts of chemicals that are allowed, and that you have the weight, both in ounces and in, I believe, milliliters or grams. I'm not sure which one. And otherwise, as long as you're sticking to those, Ohio itself, you can do quite a bit with maple syrup. And we don't have any part of any sort of a guild or anything ourselves. Like I said, most of our sales, we sell out just by local people that want our syrup.
Do you have, is it possible for someone listening to buy from you through mail order?
We do not sell anything by mail order. It is maybe possible to get some from Ohio, but like I said, since we're able to sell out from just local business, we really don't worry about it.
So it's not even something that you don't even need to do it. So it's
right.
Not an issue. Well, that's a good problem to have. Okay. I think I have seen, and this is just sort of as an aside, I think I have seen various brands, and I look at so many over the years, I don't know, but some of them might be blends of sap from Vermont and or Michigan and or Canada, and it starts to look a little bit like olive oil. Olives might be from Tunisia and Spain and Italy and Greece. It's like, wait a minute, this is, it sort of violates a sense of homely purity or something. And I might be kind of Norman Rockwell overthinking it, but that's kind of how I feel about maple syrup, because it's kind of a big deal.
Right. And I think that it's just something that, unless people have experienced what comes from a small producer, even if they're getting that commercial pure maple syrup off the grocery store shelves, there is a difference. And I encourage everyone listening that if they haven't been able to find someone, that they really go out and look, especially if they're in the northern states, they can find someone who produces it locally, that they give it a try and check out the ways that they do it and how much work it takes, and they'll appreciate it more.
Yeah, I would imagine that there's probably far more than even I would expect between Ohio and Michigan and possibly Wisconsin and Vermont and New Hampshire and everything else. It's just what a resource. I guess that's one thing I miss about being on the West Coast, is really amazing maple syrup, although we do get morels in the mountains before everybody else. So it's a trade-off.
Right.
I'm pleased to hear that the cottage food rules and the cottage food environment in Ohio is as accommodating as it is. And that's not the case in all states. And in fact, New Jersey, I'm pretty sure, has zero cottage food opportunities at all. So of the 50, 49 states at least have some recognition of that. And that's a good thing. And it's, I don't think I'm telling a secret that you are a member of my Eating Liberty Facebook group. And then we've chatted in there and about some things, including the idea of decentralization, which in what I'm hearing you say for the cottage foods movement, I hate the word, but in Ohio, that's really something that's a prominent part of what cottage food means, is you're outside of the centralized government as much as possible, as long as you follow some basic rules. And I can't imagine anyone's going to complain that a foodstuff is labeled reasonably, but what's in it, how much does it weigh? I don't think that's too much to ask.
Right.
As far as the rest of the things, are you familiar at, say, flea markets, where are there people with baked goods and other kinds of cottage food vendors going on that you see?
For cottage foods in Ohio, the law states that the places that you're allowed to sell are from home, like person to person, at registered farmers markets, which is a difference from just farmers markets in general, and registered farm markets, which are on farm locations that have registered with the state. So as far as flea markets and things, yes, people do sell at those locations. However, probably just trying to go under the radar.
Yeah. When you're taking on the state, that's probably not a good idea. It's like copyright violations and Disney. They're going to find you.
Right.
Okay. Well, that's good. So I know that there are some accommodations in Oregon, and I know that every state's a little bit different. And actually, I have a page for cottage food laws, which I will put a link for on today's show notes page, which is culinarylibertarian.com/71. But since we're talking a little bit about food, and this is the Culinary Libertarian Show, I'm going to switch into a couple of short answer questions I want to ask you. And these are kind of fun, but they're a little bit, you know, just kind of fun and silly.
Okay.
Of the five flavors, sweet, salty, bitter, sour, and umami, which one do you enjoy the most?
Sweet.
What's your favorite food?
Anything Mexican.
What's your least favorite food?
Brussels sprouts.
Oh, what gets you excited?
Unless they're covered in bacon and maple syrup.
Oh, I haven't tried the maple syrup. Bacon, I got it. My brother made a very big deal one family holiday about how bacon and Brussels sprouts simply did not go together. If you want bacon, eat bacon, which, you know, I mean, he had a point there, but boy, we love our bacon and Brussels sprouts, and also with blue cheese. That's a nice little addition, but the maple syrup I haven't tried. We may have to do that.
I've done a lot of savory dishes using maple syrup. Since my favorite flavor is sweet, that makes sense.
Sure. It does. What gets you excited?
Music.
What turns you off?
Dishonesty.
What sound do you love?
Birds.
What sound do you hate?
Chalkboard scratching.
There was, it doesn't bother me. I don't remember. I think it was the Pink Panther, one of the Peter Sellers Pink Panther movies, where the torture was a guy put on a bear claw glove and the chalkboard, and you know, so you knew it was going to happen.
Right.
What's your favorite food indulgence?
A really high quality chocolate.
Oh, me too. With these, so one of the things I meant to ask, and we talked about it, but let's say again, from, you mentioned your gallons of produced syrup, but let's just say again, from how many gallons of sap is that? Because I want to leave the listener with a really big impression of how much sap is required to make a gallon of maple syrup. And I think that that's going to, then you'll find out why it comes in small bottles.
Right. So our range is anywhere from 40 to 60 gallons. It depends on so many different factors, temperature, how much ice we were able to get out of it before we tried to evaporate it. But it could be as much as 60 gallons of sap to make 1 gallon of syrup.
And would that be 1 gallon of what you and I would call grade B?
Well, and you'd mentioned something about cooked longer and that sort of thing. And there's actually a lot of other reasons why things would be grade B later in the season. It tends to be grade B. Just the difference in the chemical makeup of the sap compared to early in the season tends to be the Vermont Fancy or grade A light amber.
Oh, that I didn't know. I like lots of flavors, but I like bitter flavor. And I find while grade B does have, of course, it has that initial burst of, wow, there's the sweet. It has, to me, a more complex flavor, but it also has a bitter note that I find very pleasant. But when you're putting it with, you know, pancakes and bacon and eggs and whatever else you're making with it, that bitterness kind of goes away. Let me ask you this, and this is just something I'm curious. What else besides Brussels sprouts have you found interesting uses for with maple syrup?
Sure. Actually, one of my favorites has been a butternut squash with a maple cream sauce that was with bacon.
All right, hang on. Tell me about how you made the maple cream, because that sounds good.
It was a reduction of a cream sauce with just a pat of butter and some syrup. And there was a little bit of bacon grease involved too, I think, because the bacon got sprinkled on top along with some fresh sage. And it was just some frozen butternut squash I'd gotten from the store. So I can get that recipe for you and we can put that in the show notes.
Well, that's not just, I mean, bacon and sage and butternut and maple. What an amazing combination.
And then, you know, just cooked carrots. We've done ice cream with it. There's just, I could talk on and on if you wanted me to.
So when I make my anglaise, my ice cream base or my sauce, I would use sugar with the eggs and then sugar with the milk and heat the milk, dissolve the sugar, temper the egg yolks, put it all back, cook it to 180, strain it, cool it, and then when it's cold, freeze it. Did you use sugar or did you replace all the sugar with maple syrup?
It was probably a half and half.
That's how, and you didn't reduce the maple syrup at all, just straight into the anglaise?
Right, because really, if you get too hard on cooking that syrup much further, it's going to turn into candy because it's already been reduced to a pretty high sugar state.
Interesting. That I've played with, I think, with maple sauces before with maple syrup, and I've always found the maple flavor was just a little bit more elusive than I wanted it to be. And I never, and I've tried different things, but I can never, you know, fake maple tastes amazing, but it's fake. And so it's harder to get that full on really strong maple flavor from like a cream sauce, but, or a cold cream sauce. Do you guys make maple sugar candy?
I have tried, and candy is one of those things that have eluded me. It's either a mess or it's liquid. Like it's so hard that I can't get it out of the pan or it's still runny and I can't do it. Haven't figured it out. I'll need somebody to teach me, I guess.
Yeah. I don't know how to do it. I mean, I've seen it so many places to figure, well, this must be easy. Like everyone's doing
right.
You know, and it tastes good, but I think I'm a syrup fan more than it looks like beach sand, and I hate beach sand. So I don't. My kids love it, and as a kid, I remember liking it because it tasted good. I don't know how they did it. I don't. If you figure it out, let me know. But I know the one place I had talked to in Mansalona, Michigan, they do it. They make that, but I don't know how. Didn't ask. This is kind of an esoteric question, and maybe there doesn't exist. If someone is interested in reading more about maple syrup, is there a book that exists that they can read about, or do they just need to go find a couple of trees and start tapping?
I would definitely recommend going to your library, checking out some books, or look online. There's probably a million different ways to make it happen. I mean, the Indians were doing it, throwing an axe at a tree is the old myth is how that all got started. So, and then the sun baked the sap onto the tree and that became maple candy then. So you can, I'm sure, find YouTube videos, and we just gave it a go and did a little bit of research, and it's not a difficult activity to figure out. It's just time consuming and labor intensive.
Well, yeah, it is both of those things. And I had not remembered the maple syrup origin stories. And there's more than a few of them, but they all sort of center around the same basic general story. And that's actually, I think that in the story that I wrote, I think there's a link to that. It's a very fascinating little bit of a read. It's obviously it's more myth than fact, but myths can be fun.
Right.
Well, I appreciate your time. Even though you don't do mail orders, do you have a website or a Facebook page people can go visit and see the fabulousness of Ohio maple syrup?
Sure. We really are only on Facebook, Menchofer Maple Syrup. And I like to post a lot of things on there, recipes. And definitely when we're in the heat of the season, I post a lot of videos and facts about how we make our maple syrup happen so that people can get a taste both visually and hopefully physically if they're nearby.
Well, excellent. Well, I hope the people who are nearby, and I know that there are actually some who are nearby. I won't say his name because he didn't tell me I could, but you know who I'm talking
right.
about. I hope he comes and sees you. And thank you again. I appreciate your time and have a fabulous evening.
Yes, you too.
All right, folks, that's going to do it. Casey mentioned BRIX, B-R-I-X, which is measured with a refractometer. It's a way to measure the carbohydrates of sap, and that alone is almost enough to let you know why anyone who doesn't need to know about it doesn't know about it. I'll put a link on the show notes page to the blog piece I wrote about maple syrup, which does have an origin story in it, as well as a few pictures of the equipment from that particular maple syrup producer. I'll also add a link to the Menchofer Maple Syrup Facebook page where you can see the pan they use and get some tasty recipes, including her maple ice cream. Casey's food indulgence answer of superior chocolates is a good answer. And husbands or boyfriends or engaged fellows, and I suppose wives and girlfriends and fiancés too, you can give the gift of chocolate decadence by buying Zee Chocolat from my link, culinarylibertarian.com/Zee Valentine, because, of course, Valentine's Day is coming. Zee Chocolat ships nearly worldwide and has chocolate collections for indulgence or chocolate collections for indulgence, because if some is good, more is better. Have a good week, and I'll see you soon. Music for the Culinary Libertarian Podcast is provided by Matthew Bankert at mattbankert.com.